Welcome to The Pestle, reviewing and breaking down the movies to look for insights into the movie-making process. Hosted by Goose and Maverick. Let's kick the tires and light the fires.
Welcome, everybody, to The Pestle. Today's show is brought to you by Lou's Cafe. Enjoy a milkshake of the highest density at Lou's Cafe. Welcome, everyone, to The Pestle. I am Wes.
And I am Todd.
And we're filmmakers, do a lot of stuff, and we use that as a way to talk about films and maybe learn something about filmmaking, acting, the whole process as people who, love movies and also want to make them at some point, TBD. But what's really fun is watching where someone who's made it, where they started. That's a really satisfying thing to be like, okay, well, Scorsese is over here directing, you know, $200 million movies or whatever. What does Mean Streets look like, for instance? And I'm sure at some point, in the not too distant future, we'll take a look at Mean Streets. But I think there's something really charming and also inspiring about seeing the beginnings. Because everyone who is not there, you're still at your beginnings. It almost doesn't matter, you know. The whole idea of an overnight success, you know, is always comically like, yeah, my overnight success only took me 72 years. I was watching an artist who was saying literally that. She was like, yeah, you know, people said, oh man, it just happened for you. She's like, yeah, you know, it happened overnight. You know, it only took 72 years. It was like, she was way late in life, you know, but there is no clock. There's no time limit on when you can make your move. As we talked about a couple weeks ago with Denny, and how encouraging and just inspiring his story is. And watching someone where they started is not an indicator of where they can go. It's often a matter of how do I make it happen with what I have? You can't always have it all. And usually at the beginning, you don't. No one starts out of the gate with their, hey, $50 million budget. Yeah, we're going to trust you with that, even though you haven't even shown us that you can manage a $100,000 budget. Like, why would they do that? Which means by necessity, you start at the low end. Like, okay, here's a $5,000 film. Here's a $15,000 film, and slowly stack your way. And that means not just being creative with your budget, but also building your story around what you can achieve. That's the kind of, as much as I love watching a nice $190 million budget film, Dune Part Two, I also get really encouraged watching, you know, a $7,000 film, you know, following Primer, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I don't know where I'm going with that, but is there an equivalent in music of watching like, Billie Eilish recording songs in her closet? That's still bang, like that's still crush.
I love that we're talking about this. I mean, it all comes down to the art itself and what's the intention behind what you're doing, rather than the gear you have, the money you have, the even the people that you have, because a lot of times you don't have a lot of people. Yeah. You don't have a gaffer, you know. You don't have lights, you know, like what are you gonna do? I think that nowadays it's almost like there's no excuse, right? You know, like the excuse is all in your head. I'm not saying that to be flippant about people who might not be making things now, you know, that should be. I'm saying it with the notion that it's easier than ever to make something. You know, like you can literally make a film with your iPhone. I'm not telling everybody to go use their iPhone. I think let's use nice cameras, you know, like when we can. But if you don't have access to that, you just have a smartphone. There's free editing software. You know, if you plan your shots, if you know what you want in your head and you have a vision, you can make anything for almost no dollars. So money is not the object. Gear is not the wall. Gear is not the wall, right? So if that's not the wall, then what is the wall? The wall is in your head. You are farther along than you actually are, right? So it's like, oh, well, you know, I can't make this movie because I don't have 50 grand. You know, well, okay. Yes, you have that vision and it's a 50 grand movie, 100%. But what if you just make a piece of it for no money, or a piece of it for, you know, a couple grand or something like that? Like, and then you take that piece and you do something with that piece, or you at least test it and you think, okay, can I get the look in my head, you know, in this one little scene? I mean, we've talked about it on the show before. I think it was Always Sunny. You know, they Always Sunny in Philadelphia, they shot on a camcorder one scene that was like 5 minutes long, and it looks like shit. It sounds like shit. It's just, you know, a couple of guys talking about this thing, and that got them sold to FX, and they've been, I don't know, 20 seasons or something ridiculous like that. So I guess, they needed to use analog. They had to use a tape back in those days. Now we have no real excuse. And it's the same with music. You know, you've got anybody with a computer, not even a computer, an iPad, or even your phone, like an iPhone or whatever, has GarageBand. I'm not telling everybody to go record an album on GarageBand, but I am telling you, if you have an idea or not, even if you don't have an idea, just sit down and make something. That's the point. The point is to make it. And it's almost kind of, I mean, watching this film, I agree. Like, when you suggested it last week, I was thinking, really? Okay. Because I hadn't seen this movie in so long.
Yeah.
And then I'm watching it, and I understood why immediately watching it. And it was, yeah, I can't wait to talk about it, honestly.
It's really cool. And I love the, you know, the point you're making. It's not about the gear. And yeah, fine. Yeah. Don't record your album on GarageBand. But you know what you can do is get your reps in. You can get better at your process of writing and making music. And so that whenever you do step into a studio, you're ready to go. Like, yeah, okay, fine. You don't have access to an Aria Alexa 35. Like, that's what, dude, we shot my last short film on a 35. And it's just magic. It's, there was a couple of scenes we didn't really even have a chance to light. That it was just so overcast. And I was like, okay. The original plan was going to neg out all, you know, these windows. And even as we were setting up, it was just like, we don't need to. There's not enough light to start negging anyway. Like, what's the point? And it looked, I mean, it's just retaining all the high. It's so beautiful. And yet, if I'm not getting my practice on my C100, right? If I don't know how to direct a scene with my actors, I need to get all those reps before I'm on set with the 35, with the one of the nicest cameras in the world. Like, what's the point? The camera's not going to do anything for you if you don't know where to put it, if you don't know how to write the scene for your actors that are in it, if you don't know how to pace the scene and direct your actors, give a note, and find the actors that are right for the part anyway. Like, there's so many other parts to making a film that has absolutely nothing to do with your gear. And if you don't know how to step into that role, the gear will never matter. It's never going to make up the gap between you and your ability to execute whatever it is you're trying to do. You need to get your reps in, and you can get your reps in on virtually anything at all. Because like you said, it's all available. Why not?
If you love the process, then the gear doesn't matter. It's of course it's icing, you know, but a lot of times if you've ever eaten a cupcake, sometimes the icing is too much, and really what you want is the actual cake. And that's the end result. The end result is not even the outcome. It's the actual process of making it. What do you remember about your films? You don't remember the final thing, like the most with the most endearing love.
Yeah.
Being on set, working with actors, working with a producer, working with the cinematographer, watching your idea come to life in real time. That's such a beautiful, like, wonderful experience. It doesn't matter, like, what the camera is. If what you're seeing on the finder is like what you had in your head, like, that's the magic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Great point.
Nicely done, man. Yeah, let's move on. This party's dead anyway.
Yeah. So today we are covering Swingers. So if you haven't seen this film, please pause this episode, go watch it. We're going to spoil a bunch of stuff.
Everything. I think that's a good question. There is one big lingering question throughout the film that I guess we'll spoil.
Sure.
About a phone call. But yeah, we'll look at a bunch of things. Cinematography, directing, and DPing. My God, Doug Liman. Blocking for cinematography. We'll definitely talk about some of the story and writing, the titles at the beginning, the homages, right, that they pay, and other such stuff and things and stuff.
Homages, homage,
Homages.
Yeah, I think, tomato and tomato.
Got it. I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
Depending on the sentence structure that you're going for, maybe.
Oh, I think you're right. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, you're a very smart human being.
Maybe. Okay. Or I'm incredibly dumb and just, I know.
No. Your money, baby. Your money. Quick synopsis of the film. A wannabe actor has a hard time moving on from a breakup, but he's lucky to have supportive friends. Directed by Doug Liman. Written by Jon Favreau. Cinematography by Doug Liman. Featuring Jon Favreau as Mike, Vince Vaughn as Trent or T, Ron Livingston as Rob, Patrick Van Horn as Sue, Heather Graham as Lorraine, Brooke Langton as Nikki, and Dina Martin as Christy.
You got digits, baby.
Yeah, what a surprise.
What's wrong? I just saw you talking to a beautiful brunette baby.
Look, she didn't like me, okay? I'm in a fool of myself.
Baby, don't talk that way.
You're so money and you don't even know it.
That's what I keep trying to tell you. So
could you not mess with me right now?
Baby, we're not messing.
We're not.
Don't you argue like a big bear with claws and with fangs,
big
man.
Fucking teeth,
yeah,
man.
Fucking teeth on you. She's just like this little bunny who's just kind of cowering in the corner.
Shivering.
Yeah, man, just kind of, you know, you got these claws and you're staring at these claws, man. And you're thinking to yourself with these claws, you're thinking, man, how am I supposed to kill this bunny?
And you're poking
how am I supposed
at it,
to kill
man.
This
you're
bunny?
Poking
yeah,
at
you're not hurting it. You're just kind of gently batting the bunny around. You know what I mean? And the bunny's scared, Mike. The bunny's scared of you.
And you got
shivering.
these fucking claws and these fangs, man.
And you're looking at your claws and you're looking at your fangs. And you're thinking to yourself, I don't know what to do, man. I don't know how to kill the bunny. With this, you don't know how to kill the bunny. Do you know what I mean?
You're like a big bear, man.
So,
Jesus.
The main character barely gets a word in on the clip that we play. So I am curious, like, yeah, it's been a while. And so after doing 268 episodes, mostly of really high-end productions, very tightly edited, you know, scripts and... Were there any bumps or did this hold up and you're just like, man, I'm there from beginning to end? How was it?
It was fantastic. it was just as long as it needed to be. It was short, like 137 or something like that with credits. Because like a movie like this, I wouldn't want this to be 2 hours or longer. I feel like get in, say what you want to say, get out. And it, you know, didn't waste my time. And, you know, when you suggested it, I was like, oh, yeah, that Swingers. What? You know, is there like a bunch of sex in it or something? And I'm like, because, you know, you think that. And then I quickly realized, you know, going back into it, like, oh, yeah, I remember, you know, kind of what this it's a, you know, story about a heartbroken guy and him trying to get over that. But also at the same time, feeling like a loser. But the thing I didn't remember, and I don't think that I like, you know, process well. There's a lot I didn't process the first time I saw it because that was way before we started this podcast and before I was like super into to film was first off all the homages, right, to Reservoir Dogs and Quentin Tarantino himself and Scorsese and Goodfellas and that shot going through the kitchen. I'm like, oh my God, that they recreated so freaking good. So that, but also, and maybe even more so just like, how annoying Mike was because he was so the scene where Ron Livingston is sitting in his apartment and he's talking to Mike and he's basically telling him like, dude, you've got a lot. The one thing that I don't remember him mentioning, maybe he did and I just missed it.
Hold on. Now that you bring it up, I debated what? Playing this clip. I prepped too. So let's go straight to it.
Perfect.
The point is, Mike, is that it all depends on how you look at it, all right? I mean, you're telling me that your life sucks. That means my life is god-awful, you know? Part of the reason that I moved out here is because I saw how well you were doing, and I figured that if you could make it, then I could make it, too.
I didn't make it.
You got an agent. You got in the unions. You know, that's your problem, is that you... You don't look at the things that you have. You only look at the stuff that you don't have. Those guys are right about you. Your money.
And why won't she call?
She won't call because you left. She's got her own life to deal with, man, and that's in New York. All right? And she's a sweet girl, and I love her to pieces, but fuck her, man. You gotta get on with your life. You gotta let go of the past. And Mikey, when you do, I'm telling you, the future is beautiful. All right? Look out the window. It's sunny every day here. It's like manifest destiny. Don't tell me we didn't make it. We made it. We are here. And everything that has passed is prologue to this. All of the shit that didn't kill us is only... You know, all that shit. You're going to get over it.
Mm. Yeah, man. So he does mention it kind of in passing when he says the guys are right. He has literally the best friends on the planet. The best friends on the planet. Say what you will about T. Say what you will about what he, you know, like stands for or how he acts with women. Say what you will. That son of a bitch will never leave Mike. He will always be there. Mike will be the most annoying, you know, self-absorbed, like whiniest little bitch. And he will always be there. And he will always tell him he's money no matter what. Holy crap. Everyone on the planet can only dream of having a friend like that. You know what I mean? Where you can just be the biggest idiot on the planet. And hey, he's just like, baby, it's okay. You know, I got you, you know? So awesome. And yes, his advice is ridiculous, but it worked. It worked for Mike. He saw the bunny. Now, granted, that just got him over to Lorraine.
Mm-hmm.
And once he realized, oh, Lorraine's different. I'm going to be myself. He wasn't seeing her as a bunny anymore, you know, but yeah. It got him over to her. Had T not drug him out, you know, constantly and built him up, give him advice. You know, there's no way he would have gone over to talk to Lorraine. No, not in a million freaking years. And then that speech, when Rob gave him that speech, I was like, oh my God. I mean, I was instantly back. This whole movie was so great because, you know, I used to live in LA. And so I recognized some spots, you know, and that speech in particular reminded me of how I felt in LA. Cause I, you know, I went there. Everybody goes there with high hopes. And do they happen? Do they not? You know, usually not. With me, it didn't. But there were several times where I felt like Mike. And I did have some friends who pulled me up. I did have some friends that said, dude, you're doing great. Just keep going. And it was like wonderful because you're away from your home. You're away from, it could be your family or just like everything that you know to be, you know, to comforting and safe. And you're in this place where nobody gives a shit about you and nor should they, honestly, but they just don't. And it's new and you're constantly turned down for shit and, you know, you're just beat up and to have these friends is just like amazing. And it's great because it starts right at the beginning where T is dragging him out and he's like, we're going to go to this party. Oh no, we're going to go to Vegas, baby. Vegas. It's like, oh my God, didn't you just say you have a thing at 9 a.m.? Like, and now he's like, well, we're going to Vegas. Like, oh my God. Okay. It really sets the tone for who T is. Yeah. So this movie went from, I don't really want to watch it to, oh my God, I'm so glad I watched that again and how fun it was and heartwarming. And you really believe, even though Mike is annoying, you really want him to find somebody, you know, you really want, or at least have closure. I didn't even care about him finding somebody. I wanted him to have closure. And I think they did a really good job in like the writing and the editing to like, you don't hate Nikki, but you don't think that they should be together, you know? And I think maybe it's because of that line you just showed where he was like, well, why didn't she call? And Rob said, cause you left. And she's got her own life, you know, like, so that kind of like lets her off the hook from being the bad guy of leaving him. And so now we see her as an actual person who's just trying to get through life like all of us so that when she calls, you know, you're not hating her, but at the same time, you're like, whoa, 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 don't take this call, bro. Get back over to Lorraine, like click back over, get off. I remember feeling when he was talking to Nikki, I was like, dude, get off this line and get back over to Lorraine. I don't know what you're doing, but dear God, you know, and he does and it's good. So anyway, I'll stop talking, but yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful film. And it's just a great example of, you can do a lot with a little. It's all about story. It's all about story and setup and payoff. And this movie has it in spades, you know? I think that the production value of this film is all in the Vegas shots. Yeah. You know, like really, like everything else, you know, the bars and stuff, you can, you know, pay a couple $100 or a couple grand to go into any bar and shoot in LA. Like it's so easy, you know? But in Vegas, that's like, that's a little different, you know? And maybe, I don't know what they did there, but point is like, that's where they put all their money, getting into Vegas, shooting in casinos and stuff like that. So, or a casino, but
that's probably accurate too. Like they had a $200,000 budget, which is,
oh my God,
nothing. And you might think, oh, well, this was whatever, 95, they were probably shooting this, and in 2024 dollars, that's still $400,000. I mean, you make a film today on 400 grand, and I've seen films, you know, and it's like not great. It's just not a lot of money. It doesn't matter what era. And honestly, in 95, $200,000 is probably even less than 400,000 is in 2024 in terms of what you're going to get. Cost of crew, LA alone is just a nightmare because everyone's a filmmaker in LA. And I can imagine getting resources on the cheap, not great. What you do have in LA that you don't have everywhere else, though, is talent. You are surrounded, you're drowning in talented people. And someone like Jon Favreau, who's been making the rounds, right? He'd done Rudy at this point. And it's just amazing, only a few years before this, to think he was in Rudy. And he is jacked in this film.
Yeah.
No wonder he's in Wife Beaters half the film. I was like, man, show them guns off, bro. He looks great. And I assume that's probably how he met Vince Vaughn on the set of Rudy. And it's like, man, okay, I got this character. Like he's thinking I'm going to write something that is pure Vince Vaughn, 100%, that he doesn't almost have to act, right? He can just come up and show up to set as himself. And then he probably living in LA for a time. And I assume Favreau is an East Coast guy. He's bringing all that to the script of what is it really like to live out here as a nobody trying to make it. And at that point, you know what? What's the comedy of living here and trying to act like everyone in LA is trying to act like they're someone that they haven't achieved yet, right? The status. And I've heard so many people say, yeah, you try to go up and holler at one of these models and they're looking at, they want to see your car keys. Like that's the first test of, are you actually someone? No, Cavalier? Okay, well, you go around the back then and you can park my car. And I don't even know if they make Cavaliers anymore.
I don't think so.
And it's just a really like lived experience is what I'm seeing. And to your point, like, you would almost expect walking into this film. This came out in 96. I probably didn't watch this until like 2001. I had no idea about this movie until I got around a bunch of white people who kept quoting it. And they're like, you haven't seen Swingers? I was like, no, I don't know. Like the sex Swingers? Like that's the only type of swinger I'd heard of. And I'm still not, I think, was there a time when Swingers was kind of a term for like bachelors? I don't know other, or is it just a reference to swing dancing? I don't really know. I think it was an older term for like bachelors, swingers. The modern term.
Oh, yes, it is. It is.
Right. And so, yeah. And it's funny because I watched it and I got it. Like I thought I found it really funny. I don't know if I would have found it as funny in the '90s, but 90% of my black friends who have watched Swingers have been like, this shit is not funny. Like they do not like it at all, which for me made it 10 times funnier.
Yeah.
And so I like that. It's so specific and it's a very real experience that I feel like Jon Favreau was, you know, speaking to, heightened, because I doubt at that point Favreau was living in that apartment. I do think, though, that is someone's apartment from,
I do too,
from production. Like they were like, you know what? We got this for free. We're going to use this thing. Yeah. Maybe we'll take out a little bit more furniture. But it feels real, right? That feels like someone's space, the crack in the wall, and you don't set deck that thing. Yeah. And the parties and the downplaying, like it's popping in there. And here you have Charles being like, yeah, let's get out of here. This place is dead anyway. And it's just loud. And everyone's, oh, man, it's so smart and hilarious without trying to be hilarious, which is funny because Vince Vaughn is clearly trying to be funny the entire time. But it's never in a way where it's always aimed at someone in the scene. It's never aimed at this very broad way. Like, even whenever he's going crazy in the pancake house at the end, that still feels targeted to the customers. Like, he's still like, oh, I'm the asshole here. Okay, it's me. You know what? I wouldn't eat here if you paid me anyway. Like, he's just obnoxious to the extreme. And it's just, it works. I think also because the cinematography doesn't ever feel like it's leaning too hard into comedy. And I think it's crazy that Doug Liman directed and DP'd. Like, you don't see a lot of that. Like, even at this budget range, you would expect he would have found someone to DP for him. But maybe you really just didn't have the budget. And I buy that. Again, $200K. It's like, man, I can have a DP or I can have a full camera team. You know what? I'll take my camera team and I'll make it work.
And that would be a great call.
That really would be, to have someone pull in focus. Cause again, they're shooting on film. This is the 90s. They're shooting on 500T, which I think is another really smart move. Film stock comes in multiple flavors. You have, for one, you have tungsten balanced, which is how you white balance. Tungsten balanced versus daylight balanced. And it's so smart to shoot 500T because, one, it's giving you the most sensitivity you can. And so it gives you the most flexibility. It's like, okay, no matter what, we need 500T because we're going to be shooting all these night scenes and interiors and on the street. So let's spend all our money on 500T. That way we never have to worry about losing a single frame of film if we suddenly need to switch to daylight. Because you know what, your 50D or your 100D is not going to work on as a nighttime interior. You need way too much light, and their budget does not allow for that, for a big lighting package. That's just not going to work. So, okay, fine. We'll get 500T, and then for our daylight scenes, we'll throw on a filter, and now we can balance it for daylight while also never having to worry about exchange or lose, you know, to a short end, the stock. And it's just a very, very smart use of budget, so that at no point do you ever feel like we're going to lose any film. Because I've heard, and I can't remember if this was on an interview or a commentary. I don't remember if I watched a commentary on this, but one way or another, I think I heard Jon Favreau talking about Doug Liman was always trying to get one more take. And he's like, oh, let me get just one more take. And they were just running low on film stock. And so they started hiding the film stock from Doug Liman. It's like, that's awesome. Oh, we can't, we got to go, man. And I was like, oh, okay, well, fine. We'll make it work. And it's just always just scrapping for everyone is just fighting for what they got. Yeah. And I think the other benefit too of this film in particular is that if you have Jon Favreau acting and having written it, you almost, I can imagine, and I don't know this is me projecting, I can imagine that Favreau is kind of standing in as a director. He may not be the director, but it's his project. It's his baby. He wrote this thing and he's been fighting for, you know, a year and a half to get the budget for it and all these rooms. He's basically your co-director without being named a co-director. And that gives you a little more space as a director to worry about lighting, and to work with your camera team. And I can just imagine there's a little bit of relief to not feel like I have to spend all this time directing my lead actor when my lead actor can be stepping in to direct himself to some degree. Like, there's notes where he's like, you know what, pause here. Maybe, you know, you're not hitting your mark, or, you know, feel free to go bigger on this next take, whatever. And then also to have your lead actor, Favreau, kind of directing the other talent in the space. Like, oh, we have these day players who are in Vegas. Hey, while I'm setting up lights, can you go walk them through the scene? you can do that and save some time and not feel like you're going to lose anything on the take. Because then now with you being confident of not holding up the process by directing and lighting, you can have Favreau setting everyone in place, and then you can roll a rehearsal, not roll it, but you can do a one or two rehearsals and fine tune without ever really losing a moment. And so I think this was a very unique situation that allowed them to do so much more than you really could in a normal film, that allowed for him to direct and DP at the same time. Like, that's, I think it's all kind of just came together in a lot of ways for allowing that flexibility and maximizing their budget at the same time. The other nice thing is, because it's a comedy, you know what? We don't need that many setups all the time. Like, there is sometimes when, yeah, okay, we're going to squeeze every last frame. But otherwise, you know what? Give me a lot of light. This is a two shot. We're just going to sit and hang out on this master and let y'all do your thing. It's Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau. Y'all are old buddies and y'all wrote this. And from what I think I remember, and I kind of get this and Good Will Hunting confused about the whole process of getting it made. But I think on this one, they were rehearsing basically a lot of these scenes while going through financing, because they just kept performing for two or three of these scenes for people, like, just to give them the vision. Because if you read it off the page and it's like, I don't really get it. But once you see Vince Vaughn come to life, it's like, oh, I get it. This guy's got the goods. And so they kept performing certain scenes and it just became clockwork for them. So that by the time you get on set, you don't need a rehearsal for some of these. It's like they've literally run this thing 400 times. Let's just shoot it. Like, we light it. Y'all are good. Fine. Let's go. And then they can probably get away with doing two takes, you know, for safety on each of these little setups, like master, close up, dolly move out. If, you know, they can hide enough film stock from Doug Liman. And it's just really impressive. And so, fine, let's a lot of light. And so many of these shots, you can just feel him being like, I don't have a lot of time. We're in Vegas. We're in this casino. Let's just pop up a really big, whatever, 2K over here, diffuse it a little bit and roll. We're going to get in and out. Amazing. But you want all that light for this because you want to see their eyes, you want to see their face, because in a comedy, all that stuff matters to create the sense of safety and comfort. And I thought this rides a really nice line between comedy and drama. It doesn't feel so lit that it pulls away from that kind of indie drama vibe, but it gives you enough lighting that you feel okay at laughing at some of the misery that Mikey is experiencing. And you want that. You want to laugh at his mistakes and his foibles, because that's the punchline. That's the joke. But you also need it to feel moody enough that you buy the scenario in the first place. Him walking over to Nikki in the bar and pretending to be like, yeah, you know, I'm on the Vegas circuit. We just heard him talk about in Vegas that he's not on the Vegas circuit. And now he's over here talking about, like, yeah, you know, making the rounds, you know, on the Vegas circuit. Like, no, I recognize you from some, oh, you know, I host an open mic. No, that's not Starbucks. You came in and you asked for an application.
Yeah, so good. No, it was about, it must have been a long time ago. No, it was two weeks ago. So good.
Oh, and he just gets clobbered. And that's, I'll come back to that in a second, because I really love the way he wrote this film. But the other cinematography stuff, and I really like this. It's the way they block for singles and this punchline in Vegas whenever they're in the trailer with the girls. And it is such a bro move on Trent's part. T is like in there hooking up and Mike comes knocking on the door like, hey, I need to make a phone call. And I love T's confidence in him. The first thing he does is hand him a condom and he's like, no. Like, I need to use his phone. And he goes out and he's naked. He's just barely covering up with a towel. And he goes and makes a phone call and he walks back out because she didn't leave a message. And the look on the girl's face is as they're all getting like really swept away in this this romance and the heartbreak. And they look at him, did she call? And he shakes his head and he goes and he just stands there and they're like, oh, and they get up to console him. And it's such a beautiful shot because without moving the camera, we move into a single through blocking. They get up and they obscure the frame. They black it out and we kind of see what they're doing. They're hugging and consoling Mikey, but it reveals Trent right there on the couch, naked. And you can feel kind of and it's just a reaction shot of Trent's frustration, right? And irritation. He's just like, oh, this is done. And it's so awkward. And it's such a beautiful underperformed moment from Vince Vaughn, because he's been so animated this whole time, and to finally see him defeated is just beautiful. It works so well. And it's all done throughout without moving the camera at all. It's a really nice cinematography move. Yeah. Without moving into a close up or cutting away at all. Great job. They also have a really nice push at the beginning of that whole sequence in the trailer, where the Vegas girls are on the couch and they're in the middle, and you have Mike and T on the ends, and T starts going into this audition story, and we start slowly pushing in on him until we're in this two shot. And what's so good is that then we start reversing into another two shot of Mikey on the couch with the Dorothy girl. And it's a really nice setup, because we start in this wide, a four shot, and then we push in into a two shot, and then we start moving. And now we have coverage. It's a really patient and really well executed, thought out plan, because we also still have a master shot of that four shot. So it's not like we never cut back to that master. Those are just two different takes where he's like, okay, we're going to set up a dolly shot. We're going to get this coverage. And then we're also going to get a nice long master shot of this whole, you know, sequence. It's really patient storytelling from a cinematography standpoint, and just very flawless. It's seamless, just really well executed. I also love the bookends of the slow pushes at the beginning and end of the film, where Mikey gets home from Vegas, checks his phone. Or no, that's at the beginning of the film. After lunch with Rob, he goes home and the answer machine starts talking trash to him, and he's listening to all his messages. As he's doing that, we do this nice slow push in, waiting for him to hear what he wants to hear. And it's beautiful and heartbreaking, because we know through that opening exposition that he's heartbroken and he's waiting on a call. And none of them, and actually all of them, are kind of salt in the wound, and it's reinforcing his expectation, because it's people like, hey, if you want to talk about Michelle, hey man, sorry, Michelle hasn't called yet. And it's all the things that he's not wanting to hear. And it's backed up whenever we get to the end and she calls. And then we do another slow push as we're listening, watching him listen to Michelle's voice. Finally, after an hour and 20 minutes of him yearning for her to call, now we're watching his face. And what I love is he finally gets that call, and we're reading his face, which is all foreshadowed at the opening sequence of Rob talking about, she's not going to call until you've forgotten about her. You just wait, man. I don't know how they know. They just know. And it's paying off right here. And then the phone call happens finally, with Lorraine breaking in. And I'll come back to that in a second, because it's so good. The title sequence. So I want to look at some of the story and writing, and obviously just jump in whenever you want. I don't care. But what I love about the title is it establishes so many things. The tone of the film is there with this kind of poppy, and we're looking at all these images of his buddies and also people dancing, and the party scene of the swingers, right? And it's establishing Los Angeles as the prime location, but it's also establishing the theme, which is the song. What is it saying? You're nobody till somebody loves you. That's the whole theme of the film. And what Mikey needs to learn is how to be someone without his girlfriend. How do I learn to be someone now that I don't have anyone? And it's a very subtle and simple entryway into Mike's reality. And I love that, because Jon Favreau wrote his breakout performance that really put him on the map as a lovable loser. He didn't write himself at the ideal part of the hero who goes in and he's just killing it. No, he wrote someone that's annoying and whining, and he calls himself whiny like 1,000 times in the film. And so we all are kind of in on it, except Mike. Mike is the only person who's not in on it. And he sucks and he's upset and blah. it's so cool. It's a really cool thing to write yourself as a loser and to find a way to make yourself not be a loser.
Yeah, well, because he calls himself out, like you said, you know, if he's oblivious to being annoying, then that just makes him actually annoying. But if he's right. like, dude, I know, please forgive me. He's like asking for help. He's like, I don't want to feel this way, you know? And it's so brilliant because in that same scene that you showed earlier with Rob, he says, sometimes you miss it. You miss it, not her. You miss the feeling of missing her. And I cannot tell you how my lowest point in my life was exactly that. Not missing the person. You're missing the feeling of missing the person. Like, oh my God, what a heady, you know, ethereal, you know, outward thinking film, you know, shadowed in this whole bro-esque kind of, you know, skin, you know, like it's kind of crazy. Like you have to invest yourself in it to get the beauty, and it's awesome. Yeah,
it really is. And on top of that, if that wasn't enough, this guy who can't pick up a girl or get over his ex or stop whining is also a comedian who doesn't tell one funny joke the entire movie. Like,
and it's true. And he's very not funny, honestly.
He's anti-funny. And that's such a smart writing move because it's really hard to be funny. And Vince Vaughn is able to step in and be the humor that we laugh at and that we know we're in on the joke. And then what makes everything Mike is doing funny is how dumb he is how bad his jokes are. And we're laughing at him getting like inner groans from everyone. Like, well, we're not in Kansas anymore. And everyone's just like, oh my God, did you just, and he follows that up with, yeah, I'm a comedian. Like, oh God, you're the worst. And that's a really fun, easy writing path to take. Like, to write a comedian who's actually not funny is a really smart way to go about writing that character, because there's nothing harder in comedy than being set up as a funny person. Like, there's that whole Seinfeld anecdote of he goes to do some kind of benefit, and before he goes on stage, he's being introduced way over the top, like way extending the expectations beyond, like, I can't fulfill these expectations. Like, the funniest person in the world. You're going to laugh until you cry. Please welcome Jerry Seinfeld. And he gets up and he's like, well, damn it. Like, I can't. No, like, I have to somehow subvert expectations now. How do I do that? And so it's a really smart, nifty writing trick to be like, I'm going to write a contrast here, a comedian who's not funny at all. Well done. Really, really smart writing. And then, of course, knowing your scene, Los Angeles, let's write fakeness. Like, everyone pretending to be something they're not. It's a really smart writing avenue to approach. And let's just keep playing up all the contrast of we're in a town where all the big shots are, and no one we meet is a big shot, ever. Like, we don't meet one cool, hip person the entire time. Instead, it's everyone that's trying to make it. And it's earnest in that way. Whenever you see some of these conversations unfold, like meeting Charles was really cool because they run into him in the bar and he's like, hey, man, did you get that pilot? And he's like, no. And I know you didn't because you're asking me about it. He's like, yeah. Suddenly, you know, Rob is feeling like, you know what? These might be my people, because he's like, man, I'm glad you're saying that, because, you know, I'm waiting to hear back on this this other role. And he's like, oh, yeah, a month. Yeah. So you haven't told your parents yet? He's like, like, damn. He's like, yeah, a month means that's a no. That's a really soft no, but it's a no. And it's really satisfying to see everyone being honest with each other when they're in safe hands, as opposed to whenever they're trying to impress all the women and they just start bullshitting everything, pretending to know people. And that's when Mike really flails, is whenever he's pretending to know people and pretending to be someone he's not, and he's struggling. And so it's whenever, you know, T and Sue get into his head about, you know what, no, man, they pump him up, they give him that great speech, right? You're a bunny, you're a bear, man, and that's a bunny. You need to understand what you have. And that's the same thing that's being reinforced by Rob. You don't know what you have. Like, stop thinking about all these things that you aren't and start thinking about all the things you are. And it's those moments when he starts to succeed. And it's a really simple character flaw that we're watching and hoping he'll finally overcome. And it takes a long time for him to understand that. And that's what makes the ending so good. And so we'll look at real quick, Nikki. So the girl in the bar, he approaches and, you know, I love whenever he goes over to her, "You're a bear, man." They start playing the Jaws theme song and it's dun, 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 which is also probably another place where they spent most of their budget is they have some really good music in here. Like, yeah, that was not cheap, unless some of that stuff got subbed in later, which I don't think so. And once you get distribution, you get picked up, you get more budget to refine your film. I don't think that happened. Anyway, so they start playing the Jaws theme song and we're watching his perspective and he's walking over. And I love that as he gets to Nikki, it's quickly, seamlessly transitions into this lovely jazz tune where it's like things are going well. Like, that's a really nice edit. The sound editing there is flawless. Really well done. Yeah. And also love the he gets home and they do that nice long take of Mikey leaving a message for Nikki that just descends into the pit of hell. Like, it's so good. That meltdown.
Dude, that, oh my God. I was cringing watching that. Just, oh, please stop. What are you doing? Oh my God. And then as he was doing that, I remembered, I was like, oh yeah, she's going to answer one of these times or something. And I remember that part. Yeah. Cause it's hard to forget that. So
it
painful.
Really is. Once it gets going, you're like, oh no, don't just put the phone down. And you see him walk away and you're like, okay, good. Walk. Oh no. We're lingering. And then he goes back to the phone. It's really good. And it's so in tune with his character. It doesn't feel out of place at all. And that's satisfying too, because if you just see a shot of Jon Favreau in any one of these scenes, you're like, that's a confident, good looking dude. And the more you get to know him though, the more cracks in the, in that facade you begin to see, so that by the time you get to this moment, you know what? This is not a smooth guy at all. And he's looking for any kind of, I don't know, entryway. And so I love what I love about the whole Nikki aspect is it gives us so much hope whenever he finally finds a moment, he gets her number and they do a great job. God, this is so well written because we don't actually see what he says to her to get her number. And I think if you were to see that, it would undercut the next moment of him destroying it. Because if you see things go really, really right, it builds an expectation that we're going to continue seeing things go right. Whereas if we saw the way he failed, he walks away with the number and we feel good about it and he's getting pumped up, we're hearing the aftermath of it, then it's like, okay, we still don't know how this could go, but we have our hopes up. And then seeing the reversal of fortune there is, it feels right. It doesn't feel like a letdown, but it all in the way that we feel like our expectations got raised beyond where they were actually going to go. That's a dicey thing to do, to, on the one hand, lift our expectations, but not so high that you feel let down story-wise. And so you feel his devastation when it all melts down, but it's satisfying to see that he had something going for him and then he destroys it. So that by the time we finally get to Lorraine at the end, we're ready for him to win. God, can you do anything right? And so it's great. He strikes a confident tone with Lorraine because he's no longer pretending anymore. He's just kind of over it. He's just owning who he is. And he's like, whatever. And she's talking to him and she's like, he makes another bad joke. Lorraine, like the pie. She's like, yeah, that's not the thousandth time I've heard that joke. And he's like, don't worry, I'm not funny. I like Lorraine Pie. And she's like, I thought only real men like Lorraine Pie. Don't like real Lorraine. He's like, I'm not a real man. Don't worry. I'm not a real man. And suddenly, you know what? That's different from everyone else we've ever heard out in the LA scene. And now he's owning who he is. He's building some confidence and she's into it immediately. At first, not so much. She's just kind of rolling her eyes at him. And then he starts owning who he is. That's when he wins her over. And then she asks him to dance. And I love that little exchange because that setup, of him going to dances. Ah, what if he doesn't want to dance? This guy, this theoretical guy, may not be in the mood for dancing, for instance. And she's like, doesn't matter. She's pulling him to the dance floor. And so now our expectations are like, freaking A, he's going to screw it up again because he can't dance. He's being forced into a situation where he's going to lose. And then he gets to subvert our expectations. At long last, he can dance his ass off. He's out there, he's spinning her, he's spinning, like, he's one step away from, like, lifting her in the air and, like, tossing her through his legs. Like, it's just killing it. And it's a great way to both lower expectations and then have a nice reveal for, like, Mikey's going to be okay, which sets up the whole phone call at the end whenever we finally see him excited about her, Lorraine, and he answers her call. And what does he do? He's like, yeah, I'll get back to you. And I love that he switches over as Michelle is saying, I love you, click. Like, she can't even get it out. Oh, man, I love it. Heather Graham steps in at the last moment to be this beacon of light. And I love that she's a blonde to add this levity visually and contrast with a number of things. One, she contrasts with Nikki, who's, you know, a brunette, dark haired. And so on the one hand, there's just this extra bit of, not specular, but a highlight in the actual frame when we're seeing Lorraine just through her color. But also her blondness is almost matching Michelle's blondness that we see in her photographs. And so it's almost like she's now being replaced by someone who looks similar. Yeah, there's all kinds of layers that are actually happening here that you wouldn't expect. Yeah, what did you think about Lorraine stepping in and that whole interaction at the end of watching our boy Mikey? He's all grown up now.
Because he's all grossed up and he's all grossed up. I mean, that's iconic. Come on. Yeah. And how much of that was written for him?
Oh, man. No idea. I want to read the script.
He had to show up and just do shit, yeah. Right? Had to. Yeah, everything about it was pretty awesome. I loved the runtime. Like I said, I thought that the acting was great because it didn't feel like acting. I never was taken out of it, you know? I mean, I'm looking at it and I'm seeing a young Vince Vaughn, a young Jon Favreau, but I don't see them. You know, I see them, their characters. Like, they're just really great actors because they're not really acting. They're just being themselves. And I think that that's one of the endearing things about this film is that it's probably a story that they're familiar with and they've been through. And so it's not really hard for them to act, you know, they're just being themselves. And that's, why not play into that? That's a strength of the film, a strength of the story. And then to have some meaning behind it and some, just like a little, you know, reminder to everybody watching. It's almost like a little gift, that scene with Rob. It's just like a little gift to everybody who's made it that far with Mike. You know, if you've made it this far, you're going to get a little gift here. It's going to help Mike, of course, but it's also going to help you. You know, it's so moving. And then to have him at the end of that scene, just stand up and be like, you hungry? You look like shit to Rob. Like, let's go get some food. Like, cheering. Now he's the friend cheering up Rob. Because of Rob. And that's the point of a friendship, you know, like friendship, you know, there. And that goes to your point earlier about the meaning of the word swingers. Yeah. It's, you know, hearkening back to the day where you just friends, you know, and then to have that moment too, where Mike makes up with Sue, who pulls the gun on those guys. Yeah. And then after 2 days or 3 days, Mike comes into the apartment. He's like, what the hell, man? You just pulled a gun on these guys 2 days ago. He's like, yeah. But, you know, explain. Like, that's guys, right? We can fight and in the worst possible way and then just make up. But instead of like us dwelling on the fact that like, hey, you just pulled a gun on those guys and they're here. And that being the purpose of this scene. Because it's really not, which is crazy because like that was a big deal. But the purpose of the scene is for Sue to make up with Mike. Hmm. And it's just very matter of fact, like, hey man, I was out of line. I'm sorry. Da, da, da. And Mike be like, No, I understand. And to Mike, forgive him in a way that almost seemed like you don't need to ask for forgiveness. I already forgave you when it happened. You know what I mean? I just needed to walk away. You know, that gave Mike more power in the story because now he's the one allowing them to fail instead of them being the one allowing him to fail, because he's been failing the entire film. The entire film. He's been failing them the entire film. In the trailer, the scene in the trailer, like, how many friends would be so pissed off? You know, like, so pissed off. You wouldn't speak to me for a month, but we would come back together. It would be fine. We'd figure it out. But the point is like they just by default forgive him, you know, and now it's his turn and he gets the chance to by default forgive Sue, you know, like
that's a great point.
And that's the story of that scene.
Yeah.
Not the bullies being there playing video games with them, you know, which is, you know, a story, but it's not the story. So
that's such a good point. Cause that is the whole point of this movie is friendship, is guy friends. And it's really not as sketchy as some of these guys are towards women. You know, it's really not about that. I mean, we've all had friends and maybe we, you know, to some extent or another have gone through phases where it's just like, whatever, like, I'm just young and trying to have fun. But it's not about any of that. It's about guys being there for each other. Every guy in this film fails at one point, at least, right? Mike is obviously continually failing, but we see, you know, Rob doesn't get the part of Goofy at Disneyland. Sue
so good.
Really fails in that parking lot, you know, and that whole gun sequence is just an excuse. Like you said, I completely agree. It serves so many functions. One, to have a fight with Mike that then they can make up and show that, hey, it's okay to be mad and it's okay to make up. And it's also an excuse for him to tell off Mike. And to say, you know what, man, screw you. You're talking shit about me, but what about you? Like, you have just been whining for the last 6 months over a girl that hasn't been your girl. Like, you won't stop and you won't get out of your own way. And he just calls him out for a good 60 seconds. And Mike needed to hear that stuff. And they both come back together. And then we see T, who's been indestructible the entire movie, at the end. Fails at picking up a girl in the diner, and she's not talking to him at all. What a great final note to end on. He's like, oh, I'm picking up a really weird vibe. Like, yeah, this sweet little baby back there. I don't know. Like, and suddenly she's literally talking to a baby. And
dude,
great. You know, it's all about friendship and guys screwing up and figuring it out and moving on and being there for each other. Because at that stage in life, especially, like, you don't have money, you don't have anything, and really lowers your dating prospects and just professional prospects, especially in that industry, trying to make it as an actor when you don't have money and the only way to get money is to get on set with people who do have money. Like, it's just a crab game, man. It's really, really hard. And to see them just supporting each other and figuring out a way to be okay with their lot in life. What a brilliant idea to shoot like 20% of this movie in a busted apartment with no furniture, because visually it's telling the story without saying a word. Like, if they had had even a couch, it really undercuts everything that these guys are going through. But to just have one space where it's just garbage and literally most of what's in the frame is garbage. And then you get into someone else's house that does have a couch and it's still cluttered with garbage. It's, yeah, it's brilliant. Like, thematically, it's all about finding how to be yourself without having anyone, how to love yourself without having anyone or anything. Like, they don't have prospects. They don't have relationships. All they have is each other and figuring out a way for this to be a good life.
So cool.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean... Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how else we can say it, you know, without saying that it's cool.
Yeah. My last little note is about the homages. And I love that, you know, they reference the Goodfellas Steadicam shot. They reference the Reservoir Dogs slow-mo walk in, you know, walk down the street. It's great. And they call it out, right? And they're having a whole conversation about Tarantino biting from Scorsese. Tarantino bites everything from Scorsese. It's derivative. And you have Rob saying, I don't know what the big deal is. Everyone steals from everyone. Cut to slow-mo
Reservoir Dogs.
And then at the end of the film, as they're going into the Derby to listen to Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, they do the Goodfellas shot.
Yeah.
They do the Goodfellas slow from the street straight through the kitchen into the club. And it's so comically hilarious because they're mocking it in the worst way possible. Like, they're not pulling it off at all. They're saying hi to like the one kitchen guy who's left and the comments that they're giving each other, like, hey Raul, hey, how's it going, man? Keep the waters coming. Like, that's, they don't have money to pass out to everyone. They're just trying to be known and to be big shots in their own little way. It's a really great, I think it fits in so many ways. One, the film itself doesn't have the budget, of course, of a Goodfellas, which is reflected in the people that they're talking about. They don't have the money of the people that were in Goodfellas, those characters. And so it's reflective in two different levels. Like, the film itself isn't working with the same budget, and the characters within the film don't even have the same status as the characters in that other film. And so it's all perfectly in sync. And it really is, you know, paying homage to them without biting. Like, that's such a fine line to walk. How do you do that without feeling like you're just ripping someone else off? Well, one, call it out, like, make it a point, like, yeah, we're doing it. We know we're doing it. We also know we're doing it in a much lazier, sloppier way. And we're doing that intentionally. It's not because we can't do it better. Well, it is because we can't do it better, but we're leaning into it. And we're going to show you that we know that we can't do it better. And that'll make this film, ironically, much, much better. Genius. Filmmaking, writing, all of it just freaking works, bro.
100%. And I definitely did not notice those the first time I saw it. The shot of them sitting at the table going around, like, revealing each of them.
Yes, you know? That's, like, the Reservoir Dog shot. That's them at the cafe.
Reservoir Dog shot.
Oh,
yes, exactly. Which I thought of you because you reenacted that with your short film.
Yeah. Which is funny because I didn't even pick that out until you just said it.
And while they were talking about Tarantino, yeah. You know, like, so cool. And I also think that it's great that they're using Tarantino as that, because he's as this example, because he's very much he very much aligns with this whole, you know, just make it kind of mentality of, like, find a way kind of thing. Yeah. How he started, you know, I mean, Reservoir Dogs is very, you know, low budget film, and he made a lot of things work in scenarios that felt like they shouldn't. Oh, you're going to be in one place like it's going to. So anyway, they reference that, I think, perfectly in the scenario that references that, following up with a scenario that references that. It's just really, really brilliantly well done and well edited, you know, and, like, planned. Like, those are the kinds of things that I think a film like this, you plan out a lot, and maybe the actual scenes themselves and the dialogue itself, like, you don't write that for Vince Vaughn. You know what I mean? Like, you just say, here's where we are. Here's where we want to get to. Figure it out, you know, and go, you know, and that's probably what they did. And that scene that you showed, the first scene that you showed, I thought was great because it was almost like Sue was forcing his way into the conversation, you know, like, mm-hmm. He did say you're so money and you don't even know it. And that's what sets everything off. And then as Vince Vaughn is, you're a bunny, she's a bunny, and you've got these claws, and how do I kill the bunny? And Sue, every now and then, will interject something, say the same thing that Vaughn said, but then, you know, Vaughn takes him over again, which establishes him, you know, as subversive to Vaughn as his character. But that felt very natural. It didn't feel like, okay, when he says this, you're going to say that. No, not at all. No way. So yeah, just really beautifully done with what they had, you know?
God, just really brilliant. And I love too that they built that sequence out, not just on its own, but then use that as a transition to the next location. So it wasn't even wasteful. It's like, we're doing this and we're going to make sure we use it to propel the story forward. So it's maximizing the runtime, and they have to build the rest of that sequence out with that song. Genius. And the other, and I'll be done, I swear.
That's great.
The other little thing that I love that's great writing is the way the guys kind of rag on each other in front of other people without necessarily letting other people know what they're doing. So like, the only times I think Mikey's funny is when he keeps calling T double down. Like, he keeps doing it like, yeah, and what happens next? Double down. It's like, stop it. You know. And then T keeps doing the same thing with Sue when they're like, this girl is really upset that Sue didn't call. And Trent just keeps throwing him under the bus. Like, yeah, it's funny because we were outside playing football. I don't remember you ever leaving to make a phone call. She's a really pretty girl. Why didn't you call her? He's just like, no. And no one can tip their hat at, you know, the game that's being played. And guys do that kind of stuff. Like, the number of times whenever I was in my 20s, like, just ruining people was very, very fun. Yeah.
Awesome.
Nice. Yeah. Final thoughts, man.
No, I think I've already said it. Great film, great example of just have an idea and figure out a way to make it, and to make sure that the story and the purpose of why you're doing what you're doing is always at the forefront of whatever scene you're shooting or whatever you're making. Just don't forget your why. As long as you have that in the end, I think you have something. It's when you forget your why and you're shooting stuff to shoot it that you know, maybe you'll lose that. But I don't think they ever lost that here, you know?
Agreed. So, agreed. Yeah. What are you going to recommend this week?
I'm going to recommend another Favreau thing. He's done a lot of things, you know, film and series, etc., whatever. I'm surprised we haven't recommended it, but I'm going to recommend season one of Mandalorian.
Which
I was very surprised, but I just feel like, you know, in a world where Star Wars is overdone and underdelivered, I felt like this was a really welcoming series done in a smart way that kept me coming back and excited for more. And it had a really wonderful payoff at the end of that first season. So yeah, Mandalorian season one.
Well done. Yeah. I'm also going to recommend a Favreau thing. Also a TV show. This one is called Dinner for Five. And this is really Jon Favreau having dinner with a bunch of other Hollywood people, usually actors and directors, and they just sit and talk about the craft. They talk about what it was like making this, and it's very cross-talky. It's like it really does feel like a dinner as people are, you know, eating and like just picking each other's brains. And it's so wonderful. Favreau, man, that guy is so smart and so humble, and listening to him talk about the craft on any level, it's always really cool. And he's definitely the kind of person where you would love to be his friend and just hang out. Everything I've ever seen from this guy, and I've, you know, listened to him talk after, I think I saw Iron Man 2 with him in attendance. And he sat and did a Q&A afterwards. And then after that, we did we went to the highball at the Alamo Draft House, and he like DJ'd for like an hour. And that was surreal. I went with our old buddy Jay Holzer, and we were just like, what is happening right now? Jon Favreau is on the ones and twos and killing it.
That's awesome.
It was so good. And so listening to him have those kind of conversations with other pros, so cool. I highly recommend it. I don't know where to find that stuff anymore. I bet it's on YouTube though. If you just kind of Google around, YouTube search for Dinner for Five, you'll probably find most of those episodes. If not, I don't, maybe on Amazon. I really don't know. I want to find them though, cause I want to go back and listen to all that stuff, because so insightful and encouraging, especially when he starts talking about his Swingers days, cause that was on the come up. And now, I mean, he's Jon Favreau now. You know, you fight to get in the room with him, and in those times, like, he's just fighting to make a friend. Like, who knows? But yeah, Dinner for Five, check that out, and stay tuned for next week. We go abroad and we go find out what's happening in Bruges. So if you haven't seen In Bruges, go check that out. It has Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson, just a dynamite 1-2 punch. And I'm excited to take a look at that. And if you're enjoying the show, don't forget, subscribe, drop us a review, leave us a note, something you want us to cover, the kind of things you find interesting to discuss. Yeah. And if you want to comment on this episode, you can do that at thepistolpodcast.com/swingers.
Nicely done. Thanks. Good pickup there. And our quote of the day is from Voltaire. Interesting. Judge a man by his questions rather than by his answers. Wow. I don't know how you find all of these, but like lately you've been really nailing it. This is fantastic.
That's so good. I love that joke in the diner whenever he makes another. Mikey is like, this says pancakes in any time. She's like, yeah. He's like, okay, well then I'll have the blueberries and the Age of Enlightenment. And he's like, what did I think? A waitress getting a Renaissance joke? Like, I should have went with the Renaissance or whatever. And she walks back by and she's like, hold on, Voltaire. And he's like, oh, yeah, I guess she did get it. I love that little moment. And so I was like, oh, let's see what Voltaire has to say. And it's so good. Judge a man by his questions rather than by his answers. I feel like that's what Mikey's doing throughout the film, is he's looking for the right question. And I love it so much that at the end of the film, Trent is asking him, like, really, it didn't occur to you to call her? What happened? He's like, man, you know, I thought about it and it's so simple. I've been, and then cut, like Trent interrupts him as he's about to give us the answer. He's finally got it. And we'll never hear it, because that wasn't the important part. The important part was he was asking himself the real questions, asking his friends the real questions. And ultimately, you have to find it for yourself. Beautiful.
Wow, that's really great. I didn't look at it like that. It's kind of like the spinning top at the end. You know, I don't get that answer. And that this little bit of unsettledness makes the film stick with you. You know, like, what was it that he figured out? This entire movie, he's been, for the last 6 months, he's been trying to figure this out. And he figured it out. What was it? And we don't ever get that. And it's so great. And it's and then you have T begging him, what was the answer? What was it? And then cut. It's just so freaking good. It's just it's a great example of a final shot, but it's not really a shot, right? I mean, yeah, it's a two shot, I guess, or whatever, but it's not really a shot. It's more of like a, what do you, you know, what is the feeling you're ending on? It's the end of a song not resolving. You know, don't leave me like that unless you have a reason to leave me like that. And that is a great, that's so great, man. Fantastic quote.
Wonderful.
Oh, I mean, I kind of want to go back and watch the movie again and just redo this episode. Honestly, which is so not what I expected.
No, yeah.
No, at all, but loved it. Anyway, this was a lot of fun. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please subscribe, review us wherever you get your podcasts. It all helps a lot. And if there's a film that you'd like to see us pick apart, we'd love to hear from you. Who knows? Maybe we'll do it. Until next time, I'm Todd.
I'm Wes.
Go watch some movies, baby.